Hello and welcome to Startup Europe, the Sifted podcast. I'm Amy, Sifted's editor.
And I'm Freya, a senior reporter at Sifted, filling in for our deputy editor, Eleanor, who's in Berlin this week for VC Networking Fest Superventure.
And Sifted, in case this is your first time listening to the podcast, we report on Europe's tech and startup sector. And on this podcast, we peek inside the Sifted newsroom, discuss the biggest things our journalists have been working on, and speak to some of the people behind the headlines.
So this week we'll be hearing an exclusive about a European defence tech fund, as well as talking about Infarm, which was once Europe's largest indoor farming company. But then this week we reported that it's now leaving Europe entirely. We'll be talking about that, as well as Checkout.com's latest valuation cut.
We're also going to talk about the startups using e-fuel to try and make flying green, a topic which Freya reported on this week. And we'll be joined by Matthias Astrom, the founder of Evrock, a relatively unknown Swedish startup, which has just raised some money, but wants to raise 3 billion euros over time to build a green rival to Amazon Web Services. So Freya's here with me today because almost everyone else on our team appears to be at a conference, and the word on the street from both Money 2020, the big fintech conference, and Superventure, where VCs go to fundraise from their investors, is we're hearing that people think there will be a lot of M&A soon. And also lots of the people who invest in VCs were at Superventure, more apparently than ever before, which is probably a positive sign for VCs who want to raise money, and also for us startups who want to raise money from VCs. So hopefully that means there'll be more money coming everyone's way soon.
Yep. And we're also still hearing about lots of fancy dinners happening at Superventure, which I think is the norm. So our colleagues are there. We've got quite an empty newsroom and they're having fancy dinners, but
having a nice time. Anyway, let's chat about Infarm. So as you said, Freya, it was once Europe's largest vertical farming company. And now we understand that it's basically quitting Europe. How do we know this? What's going on?
Yeah, so end of last week, our Germany reporter Miriam got hold of some emails to staff in Berlin showing that the headquarters there was set to close. And then we looked around, we saw that the UK facility, which was their like flagship, really huge vertical farm in Bedford near London, was listed as closed on Google Maps, permanently closed. We also tried ringing the French office, no one picked up. Other outlets had reported that operations in Copenhagen are closed. And so we sort of, didn't seem to be much left based on that evidence. We also talked to Aldi and Kaufland and Marks and Spencer's, who were all supermarkets that Infarm had previously worked with. They all said they're no longer working with Infarm. So we started to build this picture that there wasn't much left in Europe. We put this to Infarm and they gave a statement saying they had decided to shift geographical focus from Europe to high potential regions better suited for indoor farming. So they didn't say outright, we're quitting the continent, but they also weren't able to clarify where, if any, staff or sites remain on the continent. So we sort of concluded that this is them leaving Europe.
Fun bit for those of us in the office watching Freya report this story was the point when she was calling other businesses in the industrial park in Bedford to see if they could confirm that the site was indeed closed, which was...
It was quite a desperate attempt and it wasn't helpful. But
so Infarm was the best known, I guess, of vertical farms, but there were lots raising money, weren't there, a few years ago. Infarm has raised $473 million over time from big, well-known investors like Atomico and Balderton. You know, people were saying this was the future of agriculture and there would be indoor farms everywhere in how many years' times. And now it doesn't really seem like that's the case. What's gone wrong for that sector?
So one thing that's really crucial is energy prices. Electricity is a vertical farm's biggest outgoing by far. And across the energy price hikes, that's become undoable for them, particularly in Europe. They also have high staffing costs compared to conventional agriculture. So I think their idea is that eventually they'd need less people, but right now they need quite a lot because they haven't, a lot of them haven't fully automated everything. And the staff they do need tend to come at, like, have a higher salary price than conventional agricultural workers. Another thing which isn't talked about that much, but I think is really important, is vertical farming's model is aimed at replacing land use. So freeing up land for rewilding and carbon sequestration and those things. But in Europe, land is really, really cheap. So building a model replacing land use is really hard financially because it's so easy to buy land cheaply and grow crops cheaply here. So yeah, I think in Europe in particular, the land use thing and energy prices have been what's really caused some problems for InFarm in particular, but the whole industry. There have been other bankruptcies and shutdowns as well.
So we know that InFarm is currently building a facility in Toronto in Canada, and it told us when we asked that it will continue to grow its business in North America. Do we think there are other places in the world it's likely to go as well, on your point about where land is cheap or good for growing stuff?
Yeah, so whenever I talk to kind of commentators or analysts looking at the industry, they all cite the Middle East as the area where this will work. A lot of countries there are flying fresh produce in because they don't have the land like fertile enough to grow it themselves. So food security is way higher on their agenda than in Europe, and energy is cheaper, and often they're starting to have more access to green energy. So the Middle East would make sense, and InFarm got some money from the Qatar Investment Authority. So their cap table is also sort of skewing towards the Middle East more and more. They've got a big growing centre that they've said they're setting up there. Toronto is the other one that they stressed to us when we put these questions to them about where the focus now lies. So it seems to be, yeah, North America or the Middle East for InFarm.
Now on to fintech.
Yeah, so next we have news from checkout.com, which is Europe's biggest rival to US payments giant Stripe. And our fintech reporter reported that checkout.com has slashed its internal tax value of its shares by 15%, according to to people familiar with the matter. That's its second internal downgrade in 7 months. Amy, how did we know this and what does it all mean?
Yeah, so this is really something that companies do for their employees. So these internal valuation markdowns are to make sure that the shares, the kind of equity that employees, you know, the options that employees have, are kind of fairly priced. But obviously when they do this, they do send around emails. In the US, they have to file something called a 409A, which is a way that pesky journalists like us can find out what's going on. So Amy O'Brien, our fintech reporter, saw an email that had been sent to employees to let them know about this valuation markdown. So what it actually means is that the price at which current and former Checkout employees who have stock options can exercise those options, known as the strike price, has been reduced to $55 a share, down from $65 a share. So that implies a new internal valuation of around $9.35 billion for the company, which is a big drop from the $40 billion valuation that it got at its last funding round, which was in January 2022. So that's a 77% drop.
So there was a drop. This is the second drop.
Yeah. So they've done this twice now. So the situation isn't getting any better. We obviously got in touch with checkout.com to ask them what their response is. And they said, I quote, "The tech sector at large has been adversely affected by the macroeconomic environment and rising interest rates. While this may appear negative, it actually offers the opportunity to capture more financial upside over time for newly invested shares at a lower strike price, hence a good thing." I think we've heard from other companies as well that it's important startups keep their internal valuations at least kind of more or less fair, because otherwise it's not very attractive for people to join the company or stay at the company potentially. Like, there's a lot of kind of things you have to balance there. But I guess if the strike price is less at the point at which a person joins a company, then that is a good thing for them in the long term, which is what the chief people officer is kind of saying in that quote I just read out.
So do you think this is another sign that valuations are out of sync with their current market value?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, and we've seen data that suggests this, that lots of companies have just done these sort of internal valuation assessments, or investors will have reassessed their valuation of their portfolio. But if there hasn't been a publicly announced round, then, you know, no one kind of needs to know, or, you know, it's not very clear often that that has happened. But I think there's, yeah, a lot of companies won't be considered to be worth the amount they were at their last fundraise.
So lastly, in our news roundup, we have a Sifted exclusive. The European Investment Fund is set to launch a 200 million euro defence and security fund, according to a leaked document. So Amy, Europe has traditionally been reluctant to invest in defence. What do you think's changed?
Yeah, so for a long time, I guess before the war in Ukraine, European investors considered it unethical to back startups that produced weapons or battlefield tools, but they have changed their mind, basically, since a war broke out on the continent. But this word dual use basically means technology that can be used in both sort of military and civilian ways. So a good example of this, and we actually have a piece published on the site today, which I would encourage you to read, on drone makers in Ukraine. So the Ukrainian government has put lots of funding behind making drones in the country, and lots of startups that were doing other things before all were doing things like making drones for spraying crops, for example, for agricultural uses, have sort of slightly pivoted what they do so that their drones can be used for military uses. But the idea is that if it's a dual use technology, once the war is over, it can kind of pivot back to being non-defense related, and that makes it more palatable to lots of investors.
So what will EIF's initiative specifically involve?
So it says that it will support private equity and venture capital funds which target investments in defence and security technologies as long as they have dual use applications. So it's basically becoming an LP, i.e. an investor in other investors. It won't be itself directly investing in these startups, but there is now this 200 million euros to go towards, you know, the end result will be that more defence tech startups can be funded. It's also worth noting that NATO has announced an even bigger fund of 1 billion euros, which we expect will launch properly in July. Again, that's for defence and dual use solutions. But this EIF one is the first one to cover all EU countries and be backed by, you know, just the EU's money.
And we should say that we asked the EIF for comment on this. The Commission said it wouldn't comment on leaked documents.
And I think what else is interesting about all of this is it just ties into this broader trend of Europe being very obsessed with tech sovereignty. That is the concept that it's important to have key strategic technologies like, for example, defence tech or semiconductors or quantum computing or AI or, you know, ways to produce new vaccines on the continent rather than in, say, Asia or the US. And that also plays into climate, doesn't it, Freya? And that's your sort of area of specialty. How do you think Europe's doing in terms of creating and keeping strategic climate tech on the continent?
I think we're still in the midst of this battle with America for keeping hold of our climate tech. They announced an enormous bill, most people have probably heard of, last August, which gives like crazy incentives for people to move to the US to build green technologies. Europe and the UK are still sort of struggling to come up with an alternative to that that is enticing enough for founders. So I think that's the dynamic at the moment.
And still in climate, Freya, you've been reporting on e-fuel this week. What is e-fuel?
So e-fuel is a sustainable aviation fuel, which is a broad umbrella term for fuels which are lower carbon intensity than traditional jet fuel, which is made from crude oil. We call them SAF, sustainable aviation fuel. So SAF falls into three categories. There are biofuels, which are made from plant and biomass. There are fuels made from waste CO2 products. And then there are e-fuels, which are the category I've been looking at this week. They're the newest. They're the most kind of techy. They're also the furthest away from commercialization and use. But they're the one which policymakers and scientists think could, in the end, be the most promising. So instead of being made from plants and biomass, they take CO2 ideally from the air, sometimes from point of source emissions, which is CO2 captured from oil or gas production. They then make a fuel from that CO2, which when it's burnt, like conventional jet fuel, creates CO2. But the idea is that this is a circle. So we're sucking CO2 from the air using direct air capture, which is where machines pull CO2 from the sky. We then burn it in planes and release that CO2. But the idea is it's a circle and that CO2 is coming out of the air and into the air rather than out of the ground and into the air.
So we're not adding more CO2 to the atmosphere. We're just kind of recycling the CO2 that's already.
Yeah, exactly. There. That's the idea, which is kind of hard to get your head around that we're still burning. The planes would still produce CO2, but this is sort of okay.
I think it's hard to get my head around how on earth you turn CO2 into fuel. Yeah. But I think that scientific explanation is probably beyond both of us. So this week, an Oxford University spin out called OxCU. I just love how.
OxCCU, apparently.
Oh, OxCCU.
Which I just, took me a while to realize. Yeah.
I just love how any startup seemingly from Oxford has to put Ox at the front as like a marker of something. Anyway, it has just raised $23 million for its e-fuel technology. What did we find out about them?
Yeah, so first thing to note that was pointed out to me by another reporter is that that's a really big amount for a spin out. So yeah, it's interesting that in itself, I think. So OxCCU's tech is working on e-fuels. It's a catalyst that takes CO2 from, at the moment they're using point of source CO2 captured from oil refineries and gas production. But in the end, they'll use direct air capture CO2. Previously, the industry had to do two steps to get to the fuel. This catalyst can reduce that to one. It's kind of a brief explanation of what they do. That can lower the energy intensity of the process because at present, e-fuels, a scientist told me this week, e-fuels take 5 times the amount of energy to produce them compared to the amount of energy that comes out of that fuel. So reducing the energy intensity is really important. That's what OxCCU's tech can partly do. They can also bring down the cost because they remove one of the steps of the process. So yeah, this is tech that could eventually kind of help the two main problems that e-fuel is facing, which is cost and energy.
Interesting. So it sounds like it's still quite a way off, isn't it? And OxCCU is currently building a facility at Oxford Airport to demonstrate kind of how its catalyst works. And then it plans to sell on to other vendors who've shown an interest in it, Freya.
Yeah, so OxCCU are being quite clever in saying they don't want to produce e-fuel themselves. They want to sell this catalyst, which I think is a good move probably for a startup. Because otherwise you'd be taking on these huge like oil majors who are trying to get into this area. But in this way, they can like work with those companies. So Saudi Aramco put money into OxCCU. The Middle East in general is really interested in this technology because it's a big refueling hub for planes. And as we mentioned around vertical farming, they've got a lot more green energy and the potential to have even more, which we need to make e-fuels. So they're really interested. United Airlines also put money into OxCCU. A big American airline, all of the airlines are under pressure. There's policy coming in that will enforce putting a certain amount of SAF in general into their tanks. So yeah, the round was kind of a lot of strategic players whose futures are really tied to SAF working in some form.
Should we feel good about this? Or is this a sort of way for vaguely climate-minded people / oil giants to get around climate regulation and continue to fly, which is fundamentally not great for the environment?
Yeah, I was really, really skeptical. Biofuels, which is the form of SAF that we currently use most of, are kind of hated by a lot of environmentalists because they take so much land to create these crops. So there's a lot of criticism of any attempt to build an alternative fuel. Yeah, so I was originally quite skeptical. I think that if we're still going to be using point of source emissions, so CO2 coming off oil and gas to make this fuel, I think that could just be a way for these industries to continue churning out those fossil fuels and kind of have a byproduct that can make them look greener at the same time. If it could get to direct air capture, I do think it could be more positive. And I spoke to an academic from the Netherlands this week whose whole focus is on sustainable aviation. And he was really positive about it. He was saying this is like the only chance we have to get aviation anyway greener is e-fuel. He was like, we need to reduce flying, particularly like the elites and the West, because we take such a big portion of that flying. We need to cut our flying and that needs to come from regulation. But he did say like, that's probably never going to get to the levels we need. So something like e-fuel is going to be really necessary.
Amazing.
So that gave me a bit more hope about it.
Great. Let's hope governments ban private jets and OxCCU does well. finally, we are going to be hearing from Mattias Astrom, the founder of Evrock, a Swedish startup that has just raised a 13 million euro pre-seed round to build a green rival to Amazon Web Services. Over the next 2 years, it plans to raise 3 billion euros, which averages out at 125 million euros a month, to develop and operate 2 hyperscale data centers in Europe. By 2028, Evrock wants to have established 8 data centers and 3 software development hubs and employ 3,000 people on the continent. Mattias, welcome. That is a pretty audacious, ambitious goal. Why are you taking on AWS, and why do you think you have what it takes?
Great to be here. First of all, I wouldn't call that we're taking on AWS. We're helping Europe solve a significant problem. And the problem is that Europe is completely dependent on foreign clouds today. Whereas sort of the market share of European cloud players is actually only about 13%, and is dominated by US players. US storing data in an American cloud may not be in compliant with sort of European privacy legislation, such as GDPR. And that means that many companies are deciding to have their own on-prem data centers instead. Having your own on-prem data centers is terribly inefficient compared to using one of those sort of hyperscale clouds. And you will need to sort of reinvent things that you would get if you were using those services. So I would rather say that we're helping European companies and European governments to be able to be compliant with GDPR, but also get the benefits of a hyperscale cloud.
Okay, cool. So what kind of customers in particular are you hoping to serve who can't currently access, you know, secure enough cloud services?
Yeah, so the primary group is the customers that are dealing with sensitive personal data. It could be your health data, it could be your financial data, it could be sort of government data that is really sort of not possible to store in a US cloud today. Yeah. So that means that we're initially targeting sort of customers in financial services, in healthcare, in sort of automotive and defense, and help give them the same advantage as US companies would have by storing in an American cloud.
Amazing. And what are the next steps for you? What are you actually going to do now you have some of this funding?
So we're building, we're recruiting heavily. I mean, we're sort of a small team today, but we expect to sort of expand it to about 50 people during the next year. We are actually starting to launch our services for alpha and beta customers already this summer that are evaluating this. By next year, we will build sort of our pilot center outside of Stockholm, where we'll test all of our innovations related to sustainability and how you build really super efficient data centers. And the following year, we hope to start building the sort of the hyperscale clouds, one in the north, as you mentioned, and one in the south.
Amazing. And so how are your sort of data centers more sustainable than others?
Well, first of all, the bringing data from sort of an on-prem legacy center to a hyperscale cloud is giving you fantastic benefits already. I mean, the power consumption of an on-prem could be sort of 2 to even 5 to 8 times what you would get in the sort of the cloud. So that is our sort of primary target. But we've also sort of discovered that there are many things you can do to build it in a better way. By locating the data centers in the north, you don't need cooling, for example. You could use sort of geothermal cooling. You can use a new type of processor and new sort of architectures. And this is really what we want to do. We want to take the sort of sustainability into the core of what we do and build the world's cleanest cloud.
Amazing. And when you're talking about on-prem data centers, those are those kind of big servers in basements with loads of wires coming out of them that people might have seen pictures of. Is that right?
Correct.
Amazing. What will be the biggest challenges for you? I mean, that you make it all sound easy and simple, but I'm guessing it's not going to be.
No, I mean, there are always, obviously, it's a massive undertaking. It is absolutely massive undertaking. But the way we're looking at it is that we not only know that it can be done, it sort of has to be done. And I think that what we're focusing on right now is to really providing a user experience, the developer experience for the customers. And we're asking ourselves, how could we make better cloud if you're doing it today? The sort of clouds that exist today, they were built 10, 15 years ago. and technology has evolved is really to think about sort of how would it have looked if sort of Apple built a cloud? What would user interface would have been like? So I think there are actually many things we can do a lot better. And we've also looked at this when it comes to sort of data center design. And I started self the question, why should data centers be ugly? Why couldn't they be beautiful and sustainable? So while doing this, even though the sort of the first focus was sustainability and providing the sort of a European sovereignty, we're actually building a better cloud.
And the EU is obviously getting increasingly sort of obsessed with this idea of tech sovereignty, it feels like. Cloud computing is a big part of lots of the strategies that it's announced. How much are you hoping to rely on EU funding? You know, 3 billion euros is a lot of money to have to raise. Is, you know, are you hoping the EU is going to play a big part in that, or are there other people that you're also planning to tap for that capital?
The funding will be sort of a mix of sort of financial investors, strategic investors. It will be debt, and also potentially some grants or subsidies from countries or the European Union. I think that we want to help European Union with three things that is core. The first one is sort of the sovereignty part, really to make sure that you cannot depend on foreign states for critical infrastructure. The other one is the sort of the IT leadership, really providing European companies with the same sort of benefits as their American counterparts would have. And the third is really to provide sort of a leadership in green technologies and in sustainability. So we believe that we are hitting the sort of a lot of the points that the European Union is focusing on, but the funding will be a mix.
And finally, when you went out to speak to investors pre-seed round, raising 13 million, saying that, you know, you wanted to build a cloud infrastructure for Europe, what kind of responses did you get? How many people said, good luck?
So actually, we started this journey together with EQT, and we see that, I mean, which is a sort of the largest private equity investor in Europe. And we see this as a sort of the perfect partner because EQT has a venture arm, which provided the funding, but they also have an infrastructure arm with a lot of experience from investing in sort of the data centers. And they have sort of growth capital. They know exactly how much funding we will need, I mean, the 3 billion to start this journey. And it is a great partner. We know that they went and asked many of their partner companies that if there would be sort of a European cloud, would you use that instead of sort of an American cloud? And they all said, yes, of course, but there is no European cloud. So I think we're very lucky to have sort of a strong partner, but obviously we will need sort of more than one partner to make this happen.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Matthias. And, you know, I hope it goes well.
Yeah, we're making it happen. Thank you.
And that is all we have time for today. If you want to hear more about what's unfolding in the world of European tech and startups, you can find all our coverage on sifted.eu, and you can find all the articles mentioned in this episode in the podcast description.
You can also now buy tickets to our Sifted Summit, which is our big flagship event in London each year. It's on the 4th and 5th of October. You can find tickets at summit.sifted.eu, and I would encourage you to come. In particular, for me, there's going to be loads of climate stuff, which I'm looking forward to. There's also startup life stuff, health stuff. We're going to cover everything, so get a ticket.
I loved how that was like, I encourage you to come for me, yeah. To see me, Freya Pratty, me. On stage, on the climate stage.
No, I meant like, that would be the interesting thing for me, but also come for me.
Yeah, perfect. Amazing. So let us know what you think of the Sifted podcast. You can email me, amy@sifted.eu, and please join us next week. And thank you, Freya, for being a wonderful stand-in for Eleanor.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.